We begin here, we're unable to see our avatar, mm-hmm. but once we honk, we now see ourselves. We are a white swan.
Are you though? Or are you a goose?
Oh, really?
Do we need to
Oh, wait a minute.
We might need to talk about this almost immediately. What is a
wait,
goose?
Wait, Untitled Swan? Is that another game?
No, there's Unfinished Swan. Unfinished Swan.
Hey everybody, it's Fun Games with Serious People, the series where we play incredibly fun games and try to say something serious about them. I am Colleen Macklin, I'm your host. We're here at Parsons School of Design in New York City, and I am thrilled to have with me two incredible guests. We have Bonnie Ruberg, who's come all the way from UC Irvine, where you teach.
One of the most exciting things about Bo is that Bo has been writing about, has been organizing around queerness and games. Your most recent book is called The Queer Games Avant-Garde. It's a set of how many interviews?
Gosh, I think I ended up with about 25 once it was all said and done.
Oh my gosh, 25 interviews with some of the most incredible game makers today who make queer games identify as queer too?
Mm-hmm. Yep, queer and trans, yeah.
Wonderful. And some of my favorite game designers are there. I read it. I love it. You'll see my little quote on the back cover of the book.
It comes endorsed by Colleen Macklin. So that is all the proof you should need.
It's a big inspiration. And even if you're not a game designer, there's so much in there to think about and kind of it opens the doors to a whole new way of making games, I feel like.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I am really thrilled about it. In part, I get to be proud of it because it's not me. Like I did the interviews, I kind of put the whole thing together, but the insights that are in there about design and queerness and the politics of making this kind of work, like they come from this amazing network of queer and trans game designers. So yeah, I agree. It's great because they're all amazing.
And you've also written, I don't know how you do it. Only a few years before, or maybe 1 year before, was published. Video games have always been queer. And that is a kind of basically an outline of your entire philosophy behind how games can be queer in different ways.
Yeah. So yeah, that book just came out basically a year before the current one. And there's a reason for why they have come out so close together. It's because the first one is much more kind of academic theory, like here's how I think about queerness in games. But it felt, I don't know, it didn't feel quite right to just say, here's me as a professor thinking about games. I wanted to also have a platform that centers the voices of amazing queer and trans people who make these games. So they're kind of like sister projects in that way. They're two different sides, the academic and the design.
Very cool. So read them both. Go out and get them right away.
They both look really cool. I love the covers of both of them. So they'll look beautiful on your shelves.
Well, they're incredibly stylish, which leads me also to the fact that you are an organizer for the for QGCon, Queerness in Games Conference, which is an absolutely incredible academic conference focused on queerness in games.
Yes. So QGCon has been going on, gosh, since 2013 was our first event. And I was the lead organizer for a long time, but now I'm just a simple co-organizer. Jess Marcotte, who's at Concordia, finishing up their PhD, amazing queer game designer, is in charge. QGCon is this really, really lovely, warm, queer space. It's one weekend a year, roughly. And we bring together, it's about 300 people each year. We take over an academic building for the weekend and we just talk about queer games and we share queer games that we make. And I don't know, for me, it's been a hugely important part of my work, but also just my life. It's an amazing community.
Well, and I guess the reason I was hinting at the fact that the covers of your books are beautiful and this conference is beautiful is because I really feel like it is probably, you know, I've been to almost all of the game conferences. Maybe there's a few I haven't, but the big industry conferences, the more indie conferences, and I've been to QGCon several times, and I would say it's the most fashionable game conference of them all.
Thank you. I mean, I think it's a certain definition of fashion. You know, it's like the one conference where you both have like official academic-y things, and also like I would say standard attire is like those leggings that are like constellations and pictures of the galaxy
with cats.
Maybe. Cats, yeah. We have every year that I was in charge, I bought all the co-organizers some sort of fun present. We all have matching Pikachu hats with like the Pikachu ears that stick out. I have a tail that I wear every year at KijiCon. We're very serious about things.
It really is. It's incredible, and it's where I actually feel super welcomed, and I think everyone really is super friendly and very open. And for academic conferences where you feel like there's a little bit of a, I don't know, hierarchy, there definitely, that hierarchy doesn't exist at QGCon.
That's really good to hear, because that's been one of our goals all along. Like, the event wasn't just started by academics. It's always been at least 50-50 academic and designers, devs, artists. And like, that's hard actually, because academics have this very like highfalutin kind of way of thinking about the world. Academia is so hierarchical. We worked really hard to make it not feel that way. And sometimes we get it wrong. So I'm really glad that it feels good and it feels welcoming.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe it's because folks are wearing leggings and they just feel like they're in a better mood, which I can relate to.
It should be noted for the history of QGCon that that first event in 2013 featured a keynote by none other than Colleen Macklin.
Oh, I wasn't going to mention that. But
you are a key part of the history and the origin of this event.
Yeah, well, it's very close to my heart, the whole event, and all the people who participate. It's incredible. We have here Lane Nooney, who teaches at NYU. Your background's in cultural studies?
Theoretically,
yeah.
Yes. Yes. Don't ask me what that means. I have 2 degrees in it. Still couldn't explain it.
And Bo is comparative lit,
yes.
So that's
high.
Okay,
it's good to see we're working in our fields.
You're working on a variety of different things. You're really, I think, if I were to describe your work, it's game history. You're a game historian, right?
Yeah, I'm a computer and video game historian. Yeah. So I specialize in the era of American video gaming and computing. With computing, it's kind of late 70s all the way to the early 2000s. And with cool. the video game stuff, I mean, there's not, you know, it's a short history, so I've got a lot of that covered. Yeah.
Awesome. but you're founding editor also of ROMChip, which is a new game histories journal, right?
Yeah, so one of the problems if you are an academic who wants to write historically about games is that there's nowhere to publish your work, actually. There's no, like, dead... I mean, there are places you can take it, but you're always kind of refashioning yourself for some other venue or some other field,
right.
And this allows people who want to have a concentrated conversation specifically about what it means to move game history forward as a field, to have that conversation together.
I mean, it makes total sense. I mean, you've got film historians, you've got historians of all kinds of niche areas, right?
Yeah, I mean, every other medium has a historical academic, like scholarly back end to it, whether it's cinema, television, radio, even mid-century computing. There's a whole body of historians who work on those subjects.
But wow.
We've really done a really crap job explaining. I would say the history of consumer computing and video gaming is obviously a real, like, charismatic part of that.
Wow, it's incredible to me. Maybe because we've had games since before writing. I mean, games have been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. But this is really exciting, and I'm so thrilled to have both of you here today, because we are going to play a game that
broke the internet, maybe?
I think it did break the internet.
Just a little?
Yeah. It is Untitled Goose Game. We'll see if by the time it comes out you remember this game.
Anyone cares about this game?
They a lot come out at different times, but this has definitely rippled through the memosphere. Mm-hmm. There's goose memes everywhere.
I would say
right
now. It has been a historic event.
Yeah.
In the post-digital distribution, Indiepocalypse 2.0 era.
So it's Untitled Goose Game. House are the developers. They're based in Melbourne. Amazing games coming out of Melbourne, Australia. You've got Doug Wilson down there, and you've got Frog Detective, Grace Bruxner, and some other folks, I think, are doing work out of Melbourne, Australia. I'm going to start this up, and I am going to ask a question. In terms of game history, where does this sit?
Yeah, I mean, so I, you know, right now I teach a class on the political economy of games.
Oh, okay.
And that's
wow.
a very fancy word or term.
What's that mean, then?
For talking about kind of games as economic objects,
okay.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But with a more
the industry.
Yeah, but with a more critical eye than just like, oh, how do we talk about a game that like makes money or does well? Like, how do we think about games as objects of capitalism, right? So how do we study their supply chains?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How do we talk about their conditions of production,
labor,
right?
The, all of
yeah,
that stuff.
And so yeah. you know, one of the things that I try to get my students to do in the undergrad version of this course is to be able to articulate a very small argument about a game, mostly by looking at how the game is sold, who produced the game,
yeah.
and what kinds of like circuits of consumption and distribution it moves through, right?
Got it. So this is a game, is this only on Switch?
This is on Switch and PC.
Okay.
And you can only get it on the Epic Game Store. You know, Epic's positioning in one part has been that they offer better better revenue splits to game developers, right?
Okay.
So there's been a move of some indies.
So their cut is smaller than.
Yeah. So Steam, you would get, you know, maybe 70-30.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Whereas Epic's commitment, at least the last time I checked, was that Epic only takes 12%, whereas Steam takes 30%. Right?
I see.
Which is a pretty sizable difference.
Right.
Especially if you're a small developer, right?
Absolutely.
And so Epic has been trying to basically eat Steam's lunch a bit by getting in on exclusives, brokering deals with indie developers.
So this is clearly one of those examples. And Nintendo, also known for not necessarily having open doors to third-party developers, although recently with the Switch and other platforms, they're starting to really get into the indie game space, I guess you would say.
Yeah, and this is a kind of iconic indie game in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. There's not... It's hard to make a game that sells for a single price point that makes any money anymore, right?
Right.
The entire market has transitioned over to subscription or microtransaction modes of making money. So a game that you buy for a single unit of money and then you never have to pay for again,
right.
Is almost classic in a sense, right? There's something almost vintage about that set of financial relationships at this point, right? Like, you're not gonna ask me for like, you know, almost every game we interact with has those kinds of dynamics, except for a lot of the games in the indie space. But the counterpoint to that is...
you buy the game and you play it.
Yeah, but the counterpoint to that is that indie games have often struggled to be sustainable, right, for their developers. And House House did... I mean, this is a... It's delightfully made. I think it's a real... it's a real exercise in game design.
Mm-hmm,
there's
mm-hmm.
three or four simple activities.
Yeah.
There's a world with objects in
it. So this is, I mean, as far as launches go, Untitled Goose Game is every indie maker's dream, right? It came out and everybody was talking about it. It was great for, you know, memes and other things on the internet. And it was a different kind of game too, right? It just felt kind of quaint and sweet.
Yeah, I think there's parts of this game that have the making chaos out of order kind of dynamics that you see in something like Katamari, right? I think it also has a touch, particularly the setting has a touch of the kind of slow experiential gardening games or kind of like, you know, these games that are really about being set in nature or in these kind of small environments. There's a
little
there's
villages a, with people who are recognizable.
Yeah, I mean, Bo, you've heard of some of this, right? Like the work on, there's been a small strain of work about games that are kind of the exercise of producing like a small garden, right? Like this kind of minuscule set of like environmental activities that we go and escape into in this larger kind of, you know, industrial world of like right, where these are not the kinds of jobs or experiences we have anymore, right? Yeah. This kind of almost quasi-British, right, sensibility that this game has.
It's fulfilling some form of fantasy here, where it's like,
it's hearkening to, like a nostalgia that for a time period that we don't even understand, right? Or that, like, we don't have
because
any actual relationship
multiple
to.
Jobs and gig economy.
Yeah, this goose is not part of the gig economy.
No.
And I think the loosely structured goals assist with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's the list, but you're not actually being cordoned to do anything. And so I think it's a game that uses, like, a set of small elements to produce a really rich set of unique and meaningful experiences inside this really closed little environment. Like, it's a really good example of how to design simply.
Yeah.
Right? I wonder, though, like, this feels like a TaskRabbit list, right? There's something
about
it. Yeah,
there is something about it. You do have to, like, complete these things, right, to move on to the next
And I'm curious to see, like, how necessary those will be, right? Like, is it just that we have these tasks, we can do X number, we can choose not to do them? Or is it, you know, the kind of classic gating where you have to go through these tasks?
I think it's gating. I didn't get far. I got kind of stuck at getting the rake in the lake, and I was playing
a
keyboard, and it didn't feel as good. The controller does, I think, feel nicer.
Good, right? Oh, you've got a cabbage. Oh, it's time to harvest that cabbage.
Oh, I can move this cabbage.
Yeah.
I think you bet you could grab it.
But there is, Lane, I hadn't thought of that. But what's really funny about this game is it starts you off, and you're not gardening, but there are a lot of great gardening games that have been really successful and people are loving to play. And that fantasy of labor, that the garden is like, you know, you're working on it.
Yeah, this kind of back to the earth.
Yeah, yeah. Bo.
Yes.
What makes this game queer?
So if you want the start of the queer reading of this game,
there's
a bunch of scholarship on queer mess.
Oh.
And the way that queerness is associated with, like, making things messy and messing up when things are ordered and in standard taxonomy. So you're just like, I presume it's going to keep happening that you have to mess things up, like you move that bag of dirt to get the things you want by making a mess out of things.
Ooh.
My guess is that's going to...
So where does that come from? You know, the notion of mess being sort of queer activism, or is that...
Yeah, so the idea is like... that the thing that we think of as being tidy is a very, like, straight normative set of ideas. So, like, a really tidy kind of, like, heteronormative house. Or people who fit really tidily into identity categories.
Right.
And that queerness kind of messes up those categories. It messes up that way of living.
Yeah.
So there's, yeah,
it's
there's a bunch of...
It's non-normative.
Right.
And so it's not organized in a certain way that's...
And it, like, messes with that organization.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's a bunch of queer theory writing about it. And I'm gonna guess this goose is a agent of chaos and messiness.
A queer mess.
Yeah. And unless maybe he starts cleaning things up. But my thought is he's probably just gonna be a butt.
To me, okay, if as a designer we're looking at the kind of core mechanic of this game, it is messing stuff up and terrorizing people. So, but we talked about a few different games to play tonight, and a few of the other ones, which I think are pretty easily accessible. One is definitely online, and you can play for free, is called a Realistic Kissing Simulator.
Yeah, Realistic Kissing Simulator is browser-based, so you can totally just play online.
Mm-hmm.
It's two players. It's very awkward and very queer, and I highly recommend it. It was made by Jimmy Andrews and Lauren Schmidt.
Mm-hmm.
And you just stand side by side at a keyboard with somebody, and you control these long floppy tongues.
Oh my gosh!
And you kiss someone.
Just
with,
how kissing is.
It's
you know,
just
long
how
floppy
is.
Tongues.
But that's the thing. So I talk about this game a lot. I give presentations. I use it in class, and it's called Realistic Kissing Simulator. So that seems like that's the joke, that it's not realistic because it's very it's very goofy looking.
Yeah.
But then inevitably people are like, no, that's what kissing feels like to me, that it captures like a realistic kind of awkwardness.
Wow. Yeah. Like, what do you do with that long floppy tongue you got in there?
Yeah.
So that game is absolutely ridiculous and can be played in about 5 minutes, I would say.
You can play it in like 20 seconds. You can play it forever if you want to.
Wow.
As long
it
as the internet
ends.
Exists, you can keep playing it.
So, what are some of the sort of factors of that game that really, truly make it
queer, do you think?
Yeah, so I think it's a really great example of queerness in design. Mm-hmm. So it's a super simple game, but it has all these elements that relate to gender and sexuality in ways that aren't normative. So it's really big on consent. Uh-huh. So there's a whole consent mechanic. When you start, you have to hold down keys to ask someone if they want to kiss you. There's a speech bubble that comes out.
That's nice, yeah.
They have to respond, yes.
Okay, that's great.
And then the way the controls work, to have your tongue out and all floppy, you have to hold down keys so you can release at any time, and your tongue will retract.
Okay.
And then you've stopped, your consent is done.
Okay,
So there's that. There's also just the kind of freeformness. So I interviewed Jimmy and Lauren about the project, and they intentionally gave it no goal. So there's no way
There's no way to win the game.
No way
like
to
your
win.
Tongue is the longest and floppiest, or you're a good kisser.
No, there's no. There are no directions.
Wow.
There are no goals.
Okay.
And so they did that.
No
on
points.
No
you're not getting points.
No points.
No,
no quantifying of kissing.
No bases. Quantifying.
I guess you're getting to first base.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends whose ballpark you're in.
I guess
maybe,
so.
You know?
It depends, right? How you count. Like you can poke people in the eye or the nose. Maybe there's a different system for that.
Oh, wow.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Nope. There's no points. There's no levels. There's just you like lick each other for as long as you agree to, and then you're done.
Wow.
And so they explicitly think about that as a way to kind of resist the way that sex and romance have been turned into, you know, something you should
win,
something you should be good at, right? Into a game.
Yeah.
I had a student ask me once, we were talking about sort of how people use the idea of game to explain politics and other things in life. And they were like, is Tinder a game? I think probably.
Tinder has a metagame, I think, for sure.
Yeah. But this is why I also love Naomi Clark's Consenticle, which is a tabletop game that's about sex between a human and an alien. And it's about like a sexual encounter, and it has quantified bits and tokens for like intimacy and pleasure. You have to match up cards. And the first time I played it, I was like, Naomi, this is kind of messed up.
It's got like points.
Right. Like,
oh,
why
my gosh.
Are like queer sex rendered into points? And she was like, no, that's the point. Like that it's a critique of the way that even in queer communities, we still have these ways of being like, did you score really good? Did you get all the queer pleasure?
Right.
So it made it like click for me when I realized that it's like the design itself is a critique.
The fun thing about Consenticles, when it ends, you look at the win, you know, the kind of like win condition at the back of the rule book. And essentially, you don't really get like, oh, you did great or you didn't do well. You get these sort of like almost cosmopolitan quiz answers, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you and your partner are definitely, you know, exploring different kinds of power dynamics that might not be healthy or, you know, depending on the outcomes.
Yeah.
So I do love that about the game. And I guess this idea of resisting like a win state, which seems like all games, you know, if it's a game, it's got to have a win state.
No, or maybe, or yes, or maybe we don't care what a game is, or maybe, yes,
yeah,
all those things.
That's great.
But I think certainly one thing that queerness can do for us is like get us to question what the goals are and like who sets the idea that we're supposed to win in certain ways. We're supposed to want certain things, right? So what if like when you play something, instead of wanting to win by the way that the game defines that, you want to like take a different kind of pleasure? You know, you just want to like swim around with a rake in a lake for a while.
So, Lane, you said something like metagame. What's a metagame?
So I'm
a metagame of Tinder. Is there a metagame to this game?
I would say all games have metagames, right?
I mean, I think for example, like taking an image capture, sharing it online, and having it be part of the like viral sensation that is this game, there's absolutely a metagame to that.
So I'm I'm using the term metagame or thinking about it through to my friends and colleagues at UC Davis. Stephanie Bullock and Patrick Lemieux wrote a book called Metagaming. And so their idea is that metagames are about the games with about within, around, and without games. I was actually using this theory very recently. I also teach an MA class in game studies, also about the political economy of games, but that class has really turned into a class that is almost entirely focused on free-to-play games.
Oh, interesting.
So every student picks a game with like heavy-handed monetization, like in-game, like multiple in-game currencies. So we're doing like everything from like Arena of Valor to Clash of Clans to Brawl Stars to Need for Speed to like Love Live to like Nikki Dress Up Queen. It's every one of them has a different kind of game, and their goal is to kind of study how monetization and mechanics intertwine. But I have a student doing Dota. And Dota is a game where the monetization actually has nothing to do with the gameplay, right? It doesn't follow a free-to-play mechanism, so...
So yeah, the metagame of Goose Game might just be adding to the Goose memes in a big way, right? And also doing some of the stuff we're doing, which is just like, will all these things float?
Yeah, because I think some games probably have stronger or lighter metagames. So Patrick in particular, he does a lot of work on speedrunning. So speedrunning is a game within a game, right? Anytime you see a speedrun, that's a metagame, right? My student and I were talking about how Dota 2 monetizes its metagame, but not the game itself, right? And that was like we both were in my office and we just felt like our heads exploded.
Wait, what does that mean? Okay, so Dota 2, for those who are uninitiated, is a sort of mass fighting game.
Yeah.
Strategy
game,
heavy.
But the things that you would buy in the game, the microtransactions you would do are just for buying skins. They're cosmetic. They don't impact gameplay at all.
Right, okay.
Traditionally, in free-to-play, games are monetized by putting a monetary barrier between you and an action, or you and a reward, or you and an expansion, right? They actually throttle the game loop, and Dota doesn't do that. You can play Dota all you want, and the refusal to spend money has no impact on the gameplay itself, right?
I see.
And so what Dota actually monetizes is the whole social dynamic.
All the stuff around it.
Yeah.
All like the way you look and the okay.
And also the experience of participating with a group in being invested in these like weekly tournaments and all of that. Like that's the Dota isn't it's right. It makes money not off the game but off the metagame.
Yeah. So I have an advisee, Ian Larson, who's awesome, who's doing his research on Fortnite and how Fortnite use its rate, so Fortnite's free to play, but skins cost things.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And the kind of socioeconomic, like cultural side of skins. So even though you can play Fortnite and pay no money, there's a whole culture around like, what do your skins mean about you? Like, do they mean that you're a beginner? Do they mean that you're expert? Like, does your skin
there's like cool skins and uncool skins?
Oh,
kind of like in school, like if you don't have the right sneakers, it's
But you gotta earn it too. That's the thing. Like,
okay,
if you have a really rare, expensive skin and you're not good at Fortnite, apparently, like, it's very culturally, like, that does not fit the cultural etiquette. Like, you have to be good enough to suit your skin.
Oh,
and then
right.
There's a whole metagame around, like, okay, I'm gonna use a really beginner skin. But I'm really good.
So you're gonna think I suck.
But I'm gonna snipe you from the top of the tower I just built.
It's like people who just go with like the default like clothing option in PUBG or something, right?
Yeah.
And you look like you suck, but actually you're really, really good.
But then the metagame keeps shifting. So like every time I see Ian present on this, like he'll come and talk to my undergrad classes and someone in the audience will be like, but that's not true. Like as of last week.
Oh no.
Now there's a new, so like Fortnite has instituted a thing where you can't revert back to the original like starter skin once you hit a certain point, because then you would be passing yourself. So it's like this whole system where this game that's free to play, actually like you have to be paying into in order to have the social capital.
But where do you think this game sits on a spectrum of like structured to unstructured activity?
I'm unclear yet like whether it wants to look unstructured but is actually quite structured or whether it looks structured because of the like task system and is actually more unstructured. I think like it kind of depends the order of operations we're going in. Like, are we actually, do we actually need to be doing these things one by one by one? Is it just an illusion that we're kind of choosing what we do next?
I mean, I definitely remember a big part of, I feel like when queer games kind of, I don't want to use the word started, but when they kind of became a phenomenon, maybe 5, 6?
I would say 2012 is when this current movement started.
How did that, what kicked it off?
So there was a kind of core group of people, many of them trans women living in the San Francisco Bay Area, many of them in Oakland. And so that's a kind of core moment of like artistic collaboration and energy.
So it was really localized. It takes a community, you know, in a certain way for the movement to kick off.
It's complicated.
And
because,
a few games that are like recognized. Yeah.
I think it's, you know, to say it was just like that one group or to suggest that group was itself unified, you know, it's the way that artistic
artistic, right, what we think of as artistic, right, movements go. It's actually more complicated. Mm-hmm. But I think that that work inspired more people, which inspired more people.
Right.
2013 is when we had the first Queerness in Games conference, and we had the first arcade of queer games. And from there, it's just grown and grown. Like, it, you know, when you live inside this stuff, it starts to feel normal. But every time I'm on Itch, I'm like, and that's another 100 LGBT tagged games that have appeared in the last 2 weeks.
It's exploded, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, queer creators are making games that really push at the conventions of games too.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it feels to me like, so back to an initial question, we don't have to ask about what makes the Goose Game
queer, although I want to put a pin in that.
Yeah, totally. Talk that through. But what makes a game queer? We're starting to kind of, I think, get at the edges, right? We talked about Realistic Kissing Simulator not having a win condition, or being kind of, you know, having consent built into the game, which is something you usually don't see in a game. What else? What are some of the other? It's not just about LGBTQ characters.
Yeah, it's really, I think queer games is really not a it's not solely ever a representational practice.
Right.
Especially when the way you see those deployed in like AAA or big mainstream games, right?
Yeah, it's just like change the skin. And then you have two same-sex characters.
Yeah,
and there's nothing queer about them.
I mean, which has, you know, it's awesome. You know, I read a lot of fanfic about Liara and Femship. You know, when that game ended, I really went through a period of mourning.
What is that? Is that Dragon Quest?
Mass Effect.
Oh, Mass Effect. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I had many feelings about that, but...
Yeah, but that's a whole other thing. Like, queer fandom is its whole own thing, too. No, I mean, I totally agree. I think for me, what's interesting about games and what makes games queer is not LGBT representation. Mm-hmm. It's not like AAA games that have put in, you know, one more gay character. It's the way that games are designed, the way that games are played, the way that, like, anytime a game kind of resists norms that are associated with gender and sexuality. And play is like that, right? Like, games are fundamentally related to that because they're about playing and exploring systems and trying out, like, making different worlds and trying different ways of being. So yeah, I think there are certain games that you can read as queer, but there's also just the experience of playing games can be a really queer experience.
Right.
The pleasure, there's like a queer pleasure in getting to like live in this world and explore this different way of being.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And we often do try, I like your sort of, you know, non-strategic strategy of playing a game where you just sort of play it, right? We often try to not necessarily play the game as it's meant to be played, but there's a way to play it differently.
But it's tempting. Cool. Like, you get pulled in with this game too. It's like, okay, all right, we poked
at
the edges.
We want to see more.
Like, but what happens, right? Like, how do I get past the gating? Is there something that feels good about checking off the accomplishments?
Right.
But that's the thing that I really love about some queer indie games, that they recognize that they're playing around with that, right? Like, they're giving you something that's about not necessarily seeing people on screen, but like, what's an experience you don't expect? What's an experience that resists what we think games should be?
Do you think there could ever be a queer AAA game?
Okay, let's think through what that would mean.
Okay, so it means a gigantic undertaking, 200 people making the game, a big company.
So here's the problem that I see with it, and I think this probably is in your wheelhouse, Lane, which is like, okay, let's say a game takes this idea, it's not just about like skinning LGBT representation, it's about the structures of a game, it's about the designed experience of a game. Okay, let's say a AAA studio, super big, makes a really big, designed, queerly game.
Right.
It's still part of a, like, capitalist system and a normative system that is not, that's, like, part of a larger heteronormative repressive culture. So...
this is true.
Yeah. So, can a studio, can a team of 200 people working for a company of 2,000 people producing a, like, highly profitable product that happens to be queer, like...
What
would do we do?
For you, can only indie games be queer?
I've actually never thought about this question of like, could there truly be a AAA game that is like queer in all these ways? And I feel there are market reasons why I would be very skeptical that that would ever get made as an object. But I wonder if the conditions of its production, the labor through which it's produced, doesn't undermine the radicalness that is fundamental to something being queer.
It's designed by committee, right? So, and also just the expectations from a studio are that this game's going to make money. We're investing a lot in it, and it's a games are a real risky proposition.
So that's I mean, I think that's a reason why probably realistically that game would not get made in the first place. But it's like, even if it did, what would it mean?
Okay, well, here's a scenario. Here's a scenario where you might be able to have a queer AAA game. I think that as people are playing games, games like this, Untitled Goose Game, as a great example, is an indie game that has just taken the world by storm. It is probably one of the most successful games of the year, even if you set it alongside AAA games that
are out
there.
It's going to get all the...
Certainly as an indie game, it's highly successful.
Yeah.
But so more of these kinds of games might open the door to games that are made differently or might...
Sure, yeah.
Look different, and we might expect some of our expectations to be subverted in a game, potentially.
Maybe. It kind of depends what your goals are. Like, it kind of depends. Like, if you... The big... It's not the royal you, but not you, Colleen. The big you.
The big you,
If you are interested in making AAA more queer, more experimental, more radical, or whether you're interested in, like, turning focus away from AAA and being like will this game mean that we see more goose-like things in AAA? Like, maybe. But, like, is that the point we're going for, or is it more, like, kind of, like, celebrating and investigating the strange things that are currently on the margins of games?
Yeah. I think you might be right. I think a AAA queer game is a...
I wonder if that's, like, a fundamental contradiction.
Yeah. Like, I guess that would be a question for kind of what are the stakes of doing queer games work, because if it's if it is impossible for anything created in a AAA structure to be queer, then like why bother, right?
Why bother? Why bother? I mean, I think there can be things that are,
or I mean, like why direct one's efforts to the AAA, right? If its capitalist function means that it can, I mean. Yeah, that it can't quite, like, ever clip into this. Or maybe the better question is, why should AAA care?
Yeah.
That's a good
maybe place. That's the better like way of reversing that.
So that's an argument that I end up getting asked a lot, because, like, I'll go to industry spaces like GDC, or, like, it's the kind of first question that game devs ask who are outside the indie space of, like, why should I do this in my games? And so there's the easy sell answer, and then there's the hard sell answer. And the easy sell answer that everyone wants to hear is because you can sell your game to more people.
Diversity is good. More diversity in players.
Exactly. Yeah. More consumers.
Right. Untapped markets, etc. Right. Capitalism.
Totally. And that one works as an argument. Yeah. So if you're trying to like sneak something in, that one works. But in the other side of things, like there's a social justice argument to be made. There's a, you know, like AAA, I'm not a huge, well, I'm selective with my AAA games, but like there are a lot of people they matter to immensely.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of like queer people out there in the world for whom it actually matters a ton to see themselves represented in those games. So I think that's a big piece of it, just like letting those people feel what they want to feel in their game.
Even if for you representationalism is not the kind of what makes a game queer.
Right. And I think also like having that be the goal that we really highlight, like representation and inclusion, we end up including people both in games and in the production of games into systems that are like into games labor, which is often exploitative, right? Like, what does it mean to want to include more people in the development process if the development process
is deeply broken?
Yeah, not healthy. Yeah.
And the same with some triple games, like in terms of representation. So I think it's like those things have their value, but we have to take them with like a huge grain of salt.
Yeah.
And also be thinking beyond that surface level representation.
Yeah. Are there, because queer games is like, I am familiar with the large touchstones of the space. Are there like core disagreements within the theoretical field?
Yeah.
Are those like forming already?
So one of the things I really love, so I feel like my personality with these things is to be everybody's cheerleader, which is funny because I'm actually a deeply skeptical, misanthropic person. So I would say one thing we've worked really hard with the Queerness in Games Conference and publications around queer game studies is to foster like people rooting for each other. So I wouldn't say that there have been like academic fights.
Not wars necessarily, but some debates.
But so there are some points of tension, right? So take Dream Daddy, for example. There are some queer folks and queer game studies scholars.
Dream Daddy?
Thank you.
Yeah.
So Dream Daddy is a daddy dating simulator. is, I believe, its tagline. It is
a daddy dating simulator. Dads dating dads, or like you're a mom looking for a dad. Are you a?
It is dads dating dads, okay. And these are literal dads, so like men with kids. And
the kids come on the dates.
No, I don't think any of the dates involve the kids. I haven't played through all the possible branches because there are lots of different branches to the narrative. Maybe there are kids on dates. I don't know. There's at least one dad you're hitting on.
I think sometimes they meet through their kids. Yeah,
I remember that. Yeah, like one of them often has his baby strapped to his chest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a game that is like very sweet, focused on men dating men, and got a lot of praise from queer folks who were like, I love that this is not like overly sexualized. I love that this is focused on queer relationships. You can build your dad. There's a customization system, and your dad bod can involve a binder. So trans guys felt like it was much more inclusive in that way. So there's one camp that's people, queer games people, who are like, I love Dream Daddy. And there's another camp of people who are like, fuck you, Dream Daddy.
Oh, wow.
People who don't like Dream Daddy because there's no sex in it. It's like a very desexualized representation of dating and like connections between men.
Who makes Dream Daddy?
Yeah, so Dream Daddy is made by a group called Game Grumps, or to like officially produced by Game Grumps, but made by Game Grumps, broadly speaking. And not queer people, really.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so the team of core designers, I believe that one of them identifies as a, maybe as a queer woman. There's mostly their team is not queer people.
Okay.
And so that was part of the concern, that this is a representation of like romance and sexual connection between queer men made by no queer men. And that, you know,
the concern there, yeah.
There are some very valid, so within queer game studies, there are some people writing things that are like, this is such a great thing because it shows queerness in a way that decouples it from sex and therefore allows it to be like intimate and more meaningful. And then there are people who are like, it's really problematic to say that queerness is only meaningful when you decouple it from sex. Like, that's really important.
The game itself, like, what is the game's desire or intent? Like, right, is it released as an indie game? Is this a game that is trying to monetize in some particular way?
Yeah, like, no, I would call it an indie game. Okay. It is,
So that was definitely a
rift. The dating daddy. Daddy dating? Fuck.
Dream Daddy.
Right.
A dad dating simulator. Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a rift. I'd say it's like, what's interesting to me about that is it shows that there are like different viewpoints even within this thing that we think of as one community. And I think it's useful to remember that like queer people are all different people and that like there's a value in that like community claiming, but that like there are still different perspectives and like values within that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, and those reflect larger, or I mean, I guess, relationally similar divides within queer studies.
Absolutely.
as a broader
and queer
field.
Communities more broadly.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I sit in a weird place with it because on the one hand, like I'm AFAB, I'm non-binary, I'm like, I'm more closely aligned in identity with the people who are like, I love Dream Daddy.
Right.
But I'm on the side that's like, stripping sex out of queerness is a way of like taming and normalizing sex or queerness. And so like I feel very confused on the two sides.
Right.
So it's easier to just be like, let us observe what's happening here.
Yeah.
What it says about our queer values.
Right. So can we answer that question? Is Untitled Goose Game a queer game?
Do we feel like we've reached more to play?
I mean, I've gotten through.
What are our next challenges?
We're in a new place, and I still haven't found it because I'm just kind of wandering around back here.
I'll say that my response to it so far is kind of like my response to Donut County. When Donut County was announced, it took like 4 years between when Donut County was announced for it to come out, and it's not. It's a similar scale. Yeah, I'd say it's about a similar scale.
That sounds right.
And I was so excited because it's a game about holes. It's a game about just like
big holes in the ground,
right,
and making everything fall down into the holes.
Yes. And I was like, this is going to be the queerest game ever. I cannot wait. And then it's so controlled. For me, that game is so carefully designed and its puzzles are so carefully designed that it doesn't let you devolve into the kind of chaos that something like Katamari does.
Right.
And I feel like...
Which is about a ball.
It is. It is.
You're rolling and it's sticky. It's a sticky ball that captures everything. If it's the right size.
So I wonder if there isn't a little bit of that here too, that there's this like potential for this like making a mess out of things, disrupting the order, like being the agent that's like taking this like normie little town and making it strange, but maybe it doesn't push it far enough.
Well, or I think the game would either need an actual narrative.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Or the game needs these like chill gating mechanisms, right? But I think this, as fun as this series of interactions is, this isn't like the incredible machine, right? I don't like I would not be inclined to like experiment in this space without a goal endlessly.
Yeah,
right?
I agree.
It's got a to-do list. You know, it kind of fulfills the conventions of games and
there's a tip to the spear, but it's pretty soft, right? And there's
can we go back? What does that mean?
A tip to the spear,
like,
but it's soft.
The game has goals,
right? Yeah.
Right, but they're loosely implemented, right? And there's no real risk proposition to not carrying them out.
Except the possibility of not being able to continue for certain things.
Right. And so I think there are a limited number of things you must do in order to be able to enter into these new spaces, right? I mean, I wonder what the game would feel like if you probably get a better sense of satisfaction when through getting these new areas opened up to you, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It provides a very classic sense of like, oh, look what I accomplished, right? Yeah. Rather than having access to all of it at once and then doing a kind of Where's Waldo situation with like crossing them all off, right?
Right. When it becomes your incentive, right? Like more so than checking any one of those things off the list, it's like, I want to open up new space. I want to explore more.
Yeah, I want to see like what new sets of objects and interactions and people behind this thing.
I think queer potential, maybe
in this game.
The queerest thing about Goose Game is that you're a goose.
I mean, there's that. Like Lane was saying, right, your gender is up for question. Yeah. But I think actually your gender is goose. I think if I were to do...
Sorry,
like,
my pronoun is goose.
Yeah. I thought about that for a while. Like, no pronoun, just like the name of some kind of animal. I think if I were to do a queer analysis of this game, it would actually look at the response, probably. It would actually be more about,
the metagame around it.
Yeah, like, what people have done with it, and, like, in what way has it resonated with people? Because, like, the worlds I live in tend to be queer games worlds, like, just the communities that I'm in, and I've seen that it kind of resonate with people in that space. So I'd be curious to look at what people have been posting, the kind of, like, social media presence for this game, and see, like, how they've clicked, how it's clicked with clear players.
Yeah,
why
is it seen so liberatory and, right, because it's no surprise the people who like the game, right?
Right.
Like that seems, but also, I mean, a lot of the conversation it's gotten has been about the game's accessibility to non-gamers also. Like one of the, when it first came out, for that first week, a lot of the reasons it was getting into mainstream news outlets was because this was a game that people who hadn't played game, whoa. Oh, that's nice. A little like Rube Goldberg machine there.
Yeah.
That people who didn't play games were feeling like this was accessible to them.
This is a game for them,
yeah. I think especially on something like the Switch, right? And so there were stories of people like saying, oh, I showed this game to my partner who doesn't like games and they think this is a riot, right?
There was a lot of
that conversation. So it's, in an interesting way, I think mechanically speaking, it's kind of expanded the space of what maybe, you know,
a game
the normies might think games are, right?
Because
I think we've had a lot, there's been a lot of experimentation, but that it can also be kind of inaccessible if you're just not into games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are different kinds of normies though, right? There's like the people who don't normally play games normies, and I can totally see what you mean where they're like, oh, video games aren't just first-person shooters. They're also
I can be a goose.
But they do not want to play experiential queer, that's not going to make any sense to them.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the gamer normies, like there has been pushback on this game too, like where people have been like, oh, this is a game for social justice warriors. And it's like, this is literally a goose.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And the irony being like you're saying, like you could see this as a trolling game, right? And that actually clicks pretty well with jerks on the internet. So it's it's raised a politics within kind of indie games of like, who is this for? Is this really a game? Like all the things that we expect to happen.
Typically, if a game does something unexpected and great, the question, but is it a game, will consistently come up. And that happens a lot with queer-authored games and this idea of gatekeeping.
Yeah.
I think the ways in which this game has challenged a set of norms about what games are have made it kind of an obvious indie hit, and also I think accessible and sympathetic probably to queer gamers.
Yeah.
I think also like representation is an interesting thing here. Like, I know that you're a goose, but I know that for me at least, far more meaningful in a game than having someone who like looks just like me or identifies just like me. Like, I actually like kind of gender questionable, like animal, non-human characters. Like, that's, you know, that to me as a queer person, that's what feels most comfortable. Mm-hmm. So there's something kind of nice about that. Like, it's Adrian Shaw does work on this, that we think that queer people of color, like, just want to see people who look like them in games, and actually identification is way more complicated and interesting than that.
Yeah.
So I'm all for like identifying with this goose. Octodad is my very favorite character, and I am all about being an octopus too. So that's cool.
Or you mentioned the game I Am Bread to me before, just being a piece of bread.
Absolutely, being like just a wobbly,
a floppy piece of bread.
Bizarre piece of bread who's like living in some family's kitchen in the middle of the night doing strange, dirty things.
Yeah.
You're like getting dirty and everything's dirty all around you.
Well, we're an agent of queer mess potentially as our goose. We are definitely gender equals goose.
And there's a lot of object relations happening in this game.
True. So, I don't know. Should we do a vote? What's everybody think? I would say this is
a faculty meeting?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah.
I haven't looked at the bylaws.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
Do I think this game is queer?
I think it can
be. I mean, that's a historically specific question.
It is. Thank you, historian.
Right? I mean, if this... right, I wonder if I think it's not... Like, there's too much about the way indie games like this can exist now that telegraph the potential for its existence to really imagine it as... Like, this game is not unimaginable, right? This game, like, makes sense as a set of... like, there's a way that this game came to exist that is, like, coherent, right, with a large body of independent game production, right?
Yeah.
What I think raises, like, would we even be asking this question if it had not been so popular?
It's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, it's a question I ask every time I play anything, but I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think, I think for me, it's the markers that, like, make me ask that question are things like, we're playing as this, like, there's a kind of absurdity here. There's like a, you are a character that's pushing back against the kind of social order around you. It's absurd. It's the aesthetics resist the kind of like masculinist, like super straight aesthetics.
Super heroic monomyth. It's an anti-heroic.
I mean, so we were talking before we started shooting about like what's the history. I think you were asking Elena about the history of like... birds of I don't know what's poultry, what's fowl. I don't know what those things
mean. These are not my areas of expertise. Yeah.
Fowl-based games. Fowl anti-heroes or heroes in games. There's Flappy Bird.
Oh, there is Flappy Bird,
You know, definitely a precursor. Yeah. But it is a relatively untapped...
Well, it's making me think about Kevin Cancian's upcoming game.
Home Free.
But I've been thinking a lot about his game, which also you take on the identity of a dog, and he spent a lot of time trying to think about what is scary for a dog. Like, how do you represent the experience of being a dog lost in an urban space that can't communicate with humans? Like, he's thinking a lot about, like, dog subjectivity in the process of making this game. And the limits dogs have for getting their needs met, right, in any particular situation. But I think his game is much also, it's not quite an RPG. It's not quite a survival game. Like, you have to find food and make friends. And there is this potential that you could find your owner. But I think there's other There's other kind of day-to-day activities, I think, that happen that give the game a sense of like structure and stakes, purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel like we've explored quite a bit here in terms of geese, queerness, AAA. Well, I think we should just play this all night, and we'll, you know, to be determined. I think Untitled Goose Game is a great game.
But do you think it's a queer game?
We've had a lot of fun with it. Absolutely, but only because we're playing it.
I agree with that statement. That is a statement I can get behind.
Yeah. I think we make it queer.
Yes.
And with that, I just really want to thank both of you for coming by to play this game.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Lane's still playing. So.
Yeah. We're going to have to take this to a comfortable couch at my place or something and play further.
Honk!
Thanks, Lane. Thanks, Bo. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.